This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, our periodic update on Africa. Why is the Pentagon considering a force drawdown in Africa at a time when extremist groups are rooting deeper into the region? Hello again. I'm Carol Castiel. The Trump administration, hoping to prevent the United States from becoming entangled in more long wars, wants the military and intelligence forces to scale down their ambitions. Under plans now being discussed, fewer resources would be allocated to monitoring regional threats, terrorist groups that might spout anti-American speech, but do not have the wherewithal to mount a significant attack on U.S. territory. However, critics say without military and intelligence personnel on the ground, working with partner nations to help combat regional terrorist organizations, it becomes difficult to assess which groups have or could have the capabilities to mount an attack on the United States. West African leaders, specifically the presidents of Senegal and Togo, are urging the United States to stay in the fight. Both expressed concern that terrorism is on the brink of spilling into their countries, which have not previously grappled with such a threat. Parts of the Sahel, that dry stretch of land south of the Sahara Desert, have fallen to militants linked to the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda, who are offering shelter to fighters fleeing the Middle East since the collapse of the Islamic State in Syria. While there is little data on foreign militants operating in West Africa, some senior U.S. officials in the region say fighters from Syria and Iraq have turned up in Nigeria and Mali. Well, with us to analyze the U.S. role in combating terrorism in Africa and consequences of a potential U.S. retreat are two distinguished analysts. Judd Devermont is the director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, that's a think tank, here in Washington. And prior to joining CSIS, Judd served as the U.S. National Intelligence Officer for Africa from 2015 to 2018. And Joshua Meservey, he's Senior Policy Analyst for Africa and the Middle East at the Heritage Foundation, another think tank based here in Washington. And Joshua specializes in African geopolitics, counterterrorism, and refugee policy. And prior to his current post, he worked as Associate Director for the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, a think tank here in Washington. And both now join me at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Carol.
Thanks.
Well, Joshua Meservey, let me begin with you talking about these reports indicating that the Pentagon may be considering a pullback of U.S. intelligence assets from West Africa, potentially to accommodate maybe a shift in defense priorities, moving more toward countering the threat of China in the Asia Pacific. How do you see that?
First, it's important to acknowledge that these are ongoing discussions, so we're not sure what this will look like if and when it does happen. So it's important to bear that in mind. But I think there's reason to be concerned about discussions around drawing down American personnel in the Sahel region. The violent trends are very concerning. They're all in the wrong direction. Violence has increased. It's virtually doubled every year since about 2015 in that region. You have very capable terrorist organizations. And the U.S. is there with some boots on the ground. But perhaps the greatest contribution we make to this fight is through our intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance activities, drones primarily, but other activities as well. And we share that with our French partners who do have a significant number of boots on the ground and are carrying out a lot of kinetic counterterrorism operations. So this is an increasingly violent area full of very dangerous actors that is already under resourced as far as counterterrorism. So there's reason to be concerned about a U.S. drawdown.
Judd Devermont, do you share Joshua's concerns that the Pentagon is discussing a possible drawdown just as violent trends are on the upswing?
Yeah, I think this is really short-sighted. I mean, the backdrop here is that since the administration came into office and published the National Security Strategy and the National Defense Strategy, they wanted to refocus our efforts on China and Russia and sort of deprioritize counterterrorism. But our investments in West Africa and the Sahel are so small. The numbers vary, but in general, people talk about 6,000 U.S. troops in the whole of sub-Saharan Africa. The large majority is actually in the Horn of Africa, which doesn't seem to be on the table. So now we're talking about maybe 1,000 troops. Most of them are probably not even doing combat. Certainly none of them are doing combat, but sort of involved in the way that we think about our military. Most of these are security. They're doing institution building. And so I think this idea of let's take the very limited effort that we have that has real impact in terms of helping the French, as Josh said, helping the French do their operations, to move over to for China and Russia, I think that we are losing a small investment that has a lot of impact and moving it over to a place where we already have a lot of investment for very little gain.
Back to you, Joshua. As you said, there's just talk right now, but they are talking about it, so we have to take it seriously. Let's talk about other foreign troops. You mentioned France. They have boots on the ground, approximately 4,500. French troops are in West Africa, and the regional soldiers, obviously, and UN peacekeepers. Are they concerned about the potential U.S. retreat?
Yeah, absolutely. The Europeans are very concerned, the French especially. They just brought a high-level delegation here to personally make a pitch to the American administration. Of course, their Minister of Defense was just here. So they're very worried because they are doing a lot of the heavy lifting in the Sahel, and they do rely on the U.S., again, for intelligence and reconnaissance, but also logistics support, things of that nature that it would be hard for them to fill if the U.S. isn't doing that role. The other European countries are worried about the violence in the Sahel because you have immigration that comes up from that area into Europe. You have diaspora communities in Europe from that area. There's a whole host of concerns throughout Europe. Now, I think maybe that part of this potential drawdown is born out of the administration's frustration that what they perceive as the Europeans not doing enough in the Sahel, except for the French. The French very clearly have a lot of skin in the game here. But the Sahel is central to a lot of European foreign policy and their national interests. But the administration, I think, feels that some of the European countries are not doing enough. We're actually seeing increasing engagement from a whole host of European countries. So perhaps this is partially a negotiating tactic, but it also is a real discussion. And it does, as Judd rightly pointed out, this is all born out of the national security strategy, which wants to focus on China and Russia, I think rightly. But the DOD has taken that seriously and is looking to draw down.
Right. But on the other hand, Judd, and we know from our previous discussions at these microphones, China and Russia are encroaching in Africa. So why would the Pentagon consider reducing the small footprint we already have there that, as you said, is disproportionately beneficial when we also need to counter China and Russia right on the continent?
I think this is the big paradox here. And as several senators have raised and several of the press has raised, that as we have departed, as we have signaled that we're not that interested in this region, that particularly Russia has taken advantage of that. I think China is going to be less swayed by the day-to-day tactical positioning and presence of the U.S. What we're really talking about here is an administration still not sure how to assess the importance of Africa to our national security. I think that's really what's at play here. So in the first instance, the view is that we should be focused more on Russia and China in those theaters, right? Mm-hmm. In Europe, in Asia, etc. And the second one is, well, if there is terrorism in Africa, or if Russia makes gains in Africa, does that really affect the U.S. bottom line? And it seems to me that this conversation of does Africa matter, does terrorism threaten the homeland, these questions seem to be really at the backdrop of all of these debates and discussions around how do we allocate our resources.
Well, let's talk about some of the threats, because if we're talking about al-Qaeda and IS, the so-called Islamic State, it appears to me that we would be better off countering these threats in the region before they get strong enough to hit the U.S. homeland. But Joshua, let's look at these threats. There's a veritable alphabet soup of groups, the MUJWA, the JNIM. I was reading about they're either affiliated with AQIM, that would be the al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, the so-called Islamic State. Talk a bit about the groups that are on the ground.
Sure. So primarily, you can lump them in two buckets. So there's Al-Qaeda-associated groups and there's ISIS-associated groups. The Al-Qaeda, there's more Al-Qaeda-associated groups, and I would argue they're more effective, although the ISIS groups are also, unfortunately, becoming more effective. Traditionally, in this region, you really only had one primary terrorist organization, AQIM, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, which itself came from an Algerian terrorist organization. But now you've had this intense proliferation, so you do have this alphabet soup that you referenced, and there's potentially around a 10 or a dozen discrete terrorist organizations operating now in the Sahel. And again, their operational capabilities are on a spectrum, but they are increasingly effective, particularly this coalition group, this JNIM group that you referenced. Again, this is made up of four different groups that came together. It's led by AQIM. It pledges allegiance to the emir of AQIM, and they are responsible for the lion's share of violent attacks and fatalities in the region. I referenced earlier that violent incidents have doubled every single year since 2015, fatalities about the same as well, doubling every year since 2015. One country in particular, Burkina Faso, they had virtually no terror problems 5, 6, 7 years ago, and now they're suffering scores of attacks every year. So that just gives a sense of the escalation here and the seriousness of the problem. Now, these Afghan terrorist groups traditionally will speak a strong game about the United States and threatening it, but they really haven't had the capacity to attack. But the great lesson to me, one of the great lessons of 9/11, was that if you allow groups like this to have safe haven unmolested, they will eventually turn their attention farther afield.
If I could just add to Josh's point, because I see these groups as really the most formidable extremist groups that operate right now in sub-Saharan Africa. They remind me of sort of Al-Shabaab at its heyday. And I'll explain a little bit why, and Josh touched on it. First of all, it's a coalition of groups, as Josh mentioned, several different elements that work together under the JNIM banner. But important to note, at least until very recent reports, they have worked with ISIS. So these big global network distinctions haven't so far really made much of a difference in terms of what's actually happening on the ground. In fact, the leader of ISIS Greater Sahara is a former al-Marbatoun commander who just had sort of, you know, some personnel disputes and went over to make his own group. So multi-group cooperation between ISIS and AQ, the JNIM faction. It's multi-ethnic. It's Tuareg, it's Arab, it's Fulani. We understand from Human Rights Watch reports that they preach in Bambara, which is the predominant language of southern Mali. They preach in More, which is the language of the Masi in Burkina. So their aspirations are not sort of constrained by a particular geography or ethnicity, which is the next point, that it's not just in Mali, it's not just in Niger, it's in Burkina, but also attacks in northern Benin, attack in coastal town Grand Bassam in Cote d'Ivoire. So very expansive. What I think is really interesting about them is that they're both high-tech and low-tech. Yes, they'll do machete attacks and they'll get on motorbikes, but they're also doing attacks like UN facilities. Back in April of 2018, they painted one of their trucks white as a UN truck and went right into the airport in Timbuktu and blew it up. I visited a couple months later. And they're so good at finding divisions within communities, either exploiting them or creating them, and then being able to make what is an extremist attack a much more local intra-communal fight. And so that's what makes me most concerned about this group, is how effective they are at finding opportunities in the social fabric in West Africa.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Judd Devermont, from whom you just heard. He's director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and Joshua Meservey. He's senior policy analyst for Africa and the Middle East at the Heritage Foundation. And we're analyzing the terrorism threat in West Africa as the United States contemplates retreating from the region. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal Encounter listener, Mfana Sebeke Hulu from KwaZulu-Natal, South Africa. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. So back to our discussion about terrorism threats in West Africa and U.S. policy. Back to you, Joshua Meservey. Let's talk about the factors that are driving these threats, to what extent they're homegrown, to what extent they're being stoked even more by perhaps fighters coming back from the Middle East, fleeing Syria in the wake of the demise of at least the so-called caliphate of the Islamic State. What are the various factors at play?
Yeah, so I think you can actually trace the escalation in the Sahel back to the fall of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. When that happened, there were highly trained, well-armed Tuaregs, who are a very large tribe that spans the Sahel region. And they returned home to northern Mali, essentially. And in northern Mali, they joined both secessionist groups, which have a long-running history in that region, but also terrorist organizations. And they brought a certain capacity and, again, weapons with them. And weapons didn't just come with the Tuareg, but they made it into these illicit networks and spread throughout the region, even up into the Middle East and down sub-Saharan Africa. So you saw a real escalation in violence in Mali that took a French intervention to push back as it moved south towards the capital of Bamako. But the problem was never solved, and it's just metastasized. And so now it's spilled over the borders. And Mali, it may not have as many violent incidents now as perhaps Burkina does or some other countries, but it still remains the hotbed and sort of the volcano that's spewing out this instability. And unfortunately, the government in Bamako is a basket case, frankly. And until there is an effective, competent, honest government in Bamako, the best outside intervention can do, including the United States, is essentially put a Band-Aid on this.
Judd Devermont, your take on what factors are driving these groups, to what extent it's outside, to what extent it's indigenous, economic, ideological, poor governance.
Yeah, I agree with Josh that Libya was the match that lit the fire. But the important part of that analogy is that the tinder was dry, that governance issues pre-existed the Libya crisis. There had been 3 Tuareg rebellions before Muammar Gaddafi fell. And the governments of Mali, the successive governments of Mali, have viewed the north as not really part of Mali and not worth the investments. And as we have been in this crisis now for several years, it is clear that it's still the problem, that the government of Mali has no political incentives to redistribute power and to address some of the governance issues in the north or to share power. And they actually see political costs to do that because the majority of the population in Mali is in the south. And that population believes that making concessions to the Tuaregs in the north. And let me just add one other thing that becomes relevant when we talk about Burkina. The government it's not just inaction or neglect. It's human rights abuses, particularly in Burkina Faso, which I think does want to integrate and address this problem and sees it as existential, but is doing all the wrong things. We know from literature, according to surveys, that 71% of former militants say they joined an extremist group because a family member or a close relative was detained or killed by security services. And the high level of abuses in these areas is pushing more and more people into the arms of the extremist groups.
Back to you, Joshua. In my introduction, I referred to the presidents of Senegal and Togo, that they're concerned about terrorism spilling over into their countries. Do they have a point?
Yeah, absolutely. Traditionally, those two countries haven't had at all the same struggle that other Sahelian countries have. But part of this escalation we're seeing in the Sahel is that these terrorist organizations are starting to operate farther and farther afield. I think Judd mentioned the Grand Bassam attack in Cote d'Ivoire. That's a coastal resort town in Cote d'Ivoire. And so that is significantly removed from the normal areas of operation for these groups. And that was actually one of a series of 3 attacks that the Al-Qaeda affiliate in that region launched. And I think part of those series of attacks was to demonstrate exactly this, that they did have broader reach and people should fear them. So Senegal and Togo both have very legitimate reasons to worry that this is going to continue to escalate, continue to expand, even though they're somewhat geographically removed. They're not in the epicenter like Mali or Burkina or Niger. These groups are expanding just very rapidly. So I would absolutely be concerned for these countries.
And how about the financing Judd Devermont, where are these groups getting their financing, or do they have any other sponsors, backers, in your view?
It's fairly opaque. I think sort of the most conservative judgment is they're doing it on kidnap for ransom, pillaging, taxing local communities. I think that is a big portion of how they sort of remain active. Now, you know, others have suggested that perhaps they're getting financial transfers from the networks. That may be true, but I would ascribe that to less consequential to their existence and their operations.
Back to you, Joshua. So we're mostly talking about Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups, but there's also Islamic State groups. And to what extent are they cooperating, or are they rivals?
So there are Islamic State groups. Islamic State Greater Sahara is one. Then in more in the Lake Chad Basin region, Nigeria, there's Islamic State West Africa Province, which is unfortunately, a very effective terrorist organization. So in the Middle East context, ISIS and Al-Qaeda did not get along. In fact, there's many examples of them even killing each other. But there also are examples of tactical cooperation, because these groups can be fairly pragmatic. So if there is target of opportunity or something that they think will be mutually beneficial, frequently they can cooperate. And we're seeing some of that in the Sahel. We shouldn't suggest they're partners or anything like that. They're not. They remain distinct. But again, you are seeing some few signs of cooperation, pragmatic cooperation here and there. There are ideologies. There's a lot of overlap, but there are still some different sort of philosophical approaches that keep them apart. But it is yet another worrisome element here that there is some, you know, cross-pollination between these groups.
How do you see that, Judd? Add or subtract to what Joshua said?
I agree about the different networks that operate. I'm having a harder time, at least right now, to think about and identify huge differences in ideology. They tend to operate largely the same way in terms of developing relations with communities. Some people will look at beheadings and say, well, that's a ISIS tactic, but I don't see a huge amount of difference in what they're trying to do or how they operate day in, day out. Now, there is a group that clearly was not operating the way ISIS wanted them to, and that's Boko Haram. So Boko Haram had been affiliated with ISIS under the leadership of Abubakar Shekau, and then they had a falling out because Boko Haram largely just pillages and kills. It's not interested in governance or winning hearts and minds. And so ISIS sort of took its affiliation away from Shekau and handed it to another group. And that's why in Nigeria, you have Boko Haram or JAS unaffiliated with either of the global networks. And then you have this other faction, ISIS West Africa, that Josh mentioned, that is affiliated and does a lot more hearts and minds. And because of that, much more effective.
As we close, gentlemen, back to you, Joshua, to the beginning where we began with the consequences of a potential U.S. withdrawal. Both of you seem to intimate that the costs of withdrawing, you know, outweigh the benefits. The small footprint that we do have there, the United States, has a disproportionate positive influence on security in the region and therefore our security. How do you see this playing out? Do you think that perhaps with the election coming up, Mr. Trump, you know, talking about wanting to withdraw, if that's a factor, or do you think that cooler heads may prevail?
I think there is going to be, and again, we're completely in speculative territory here, but I do think there's obviously going to be some sort of drawdown, or optimization is the term of art that is being used. But I'm hopeful that some core capabilities will remain. I think the cooperation with the French and our other European partners and local partners will remain. The U.S. has invested in a big drone base in Agadez, Niger. It just came online fully very recently, so it would be a bit surprising if the U.S. just walked away from that significant investment. I guess it could turn it over to Nigerians, but the Nigerians' capacity to operate something like that is just not to the level that the U.S. could do it. It's always useful to look at these things and make sure that they are being as efficient and money is as well spent as possible. So I'm not completely pessimistic about this. I am concerned, but we also just have to wait and see what this ultimately looks like.
And you get the last word, Judd, whether you're optimistic, pessimistic, and obviously this is a bipartisan interest.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's about U.S. National security.
Well, that's where I'm optimistic. If this is going to be reversed or it's going to be modified, or it's going to be sort of done in a rational way, it's because members in Congress are speaking up about this. And I've been very impressed about the bipartisan nature of concern, whether it is Senator Coons and Senator Graham on the Senate side, or Representative Anthony Brown on the Hill side, and others who have written letters to Secretary Esper to voice their concerns about this. And I think that if that kind of pressure will, if anything, is going to make sure that we don't do things that we regret ultimately, that we walk away from what I think is probably a reckless policy, spoken up and really questioned and asked to stress test this.
Well, on that relatively optimistic note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Judd Devermont, Director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and Joshua Meservey. He's Senior Policy Analyst for Africa and the Middle East at the Heritage Foundation. Gentlemen, as always, thanks so much for coming in and sharing your insights. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Kim Lewis for booking our guests. Our engineer was Kevin Fowler. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.